It's my great pleasure to welcome, for the first time to many Rivers Books and Tea, Sam Webster, PhD. Dr. Webster, Stuart and I have had the pleasure of interviewing Sam on our radio show twice. We don't always ask everyone back twice, so that will give you some indication of our appreciation of his work. Sam has quite the long bio list. He is a mage, hails from the Bay Area now, although originally the East Coast. Has taught magic publicly since 1984, graduated from Star King School for the Ministry at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley in 1993, earned his doctorate at the University of Bristol in the UK, studying pagan history under Professor Ronald Hutton. He's an adept of the Golden Dawn, a co-founder of the Chthonic Uranian Templar Order, and an initiate of Wiccan, Druid, Buddhist, Hindu, and Masonic traditions. His work has been published in journals such as Green Egg and Gnosis, and he writes the At the Helm blog on Paphios. In 2010, this book over here, Tantric Dilemma, was first published. In fact, that was that publishing act established is the publishing house of his group, Concrescent Press. In 2001, he founded the Open Source Order of the Golden Dawn. So think about that, Open Source Order of the Golden Dawn. If you know anything about the Golden Dawn, that's an interesting juxtaposition right there. In 2013, he founded the Pantheon Foundation. He serves the pagan community as a priest of Hermes. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sam Webster to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Well, thank you for that very warm introduction. I really appreciate it. Good evening. I'm here to talk about bringing tantric methodology, tantric practice, into Western practice. But before we get into that, as I've learned from both Masons and Buddhists, before beginning in any worthwhile or important activity, it's worthwhile to ask for the blessings of, well, you can take your pick. Heaven is what the Masons say. So there's a method that I use that is called taking refuge. Instead of the prayer form you may know from the Buddhist tradition, this is from the Dzogchen tradition. It just uses sound. And what we do is we sound the syllable ah three times. If you care to join me for this, you'd be most welcome. The first ah is to ask for help, and to think of all the beings that you would go to for help. The Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the deities, the spirits, the ancestors, the past, the present, the future, the very ground of being, the world around us, all our friends and relations, and the already enlightened nature within each and every one of us. So the first ah is kind of the asking for that. The second ah is they all turn towards each and every one of us and sound ah with us and send blessing back. The traditional imagery is we sound this ah and imagine a white letter A in our hearts. Of course, you know, for the Indians, it's an Indian Sanskrit ah. For the Tibetans, it's a Tibetan ah. I use a nice little Roman times Roman white letter A. I'm a typesetter by trade. and we send out white light in all directions. And with the second ah, they all wake up, fire up a little A in their own hearts, and they send that blessing back towards us, and that fills us up with all the good stuff and pushes out all the bad stuff to be composted. And then, so that's the second ah. And then the third ah, it's we and they all light up and shed a blessing upon all of the cosmos, all beings, that they may benefit thereof. So the first ah is to ask for help, the second ah is to receive that help, and the third ah is to share that help. So, if you care to join me, three ahs. Thank you. It would help me to be able to talk, to know a little bit of who I'm talking to. Maybe we go around the room, maybe starting over here, and say your name so I hear you, and tell me a little bit about your the basis of your spiritual practice, or Western, Eastern, name it, whatever works for you, just a sentence or two.
Okay, I'm Jim.
Hi, Jim.
I studied Buddhism in Korea and Japan, and I was a monastic for about 6 years, and I returned my monastic precepts. I also was a chaplain at a prison for the criminally insane, and through a long and complicated journey, I ended up as a practicing Quaker.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Sir, if you will.
I'm Will.
Hello.
And I'm Protestant, but very much into the Hesychast movement, Philokalia.
Hmm.
Yeah, so which is more Orthodox Christian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lovely, thank you.
That's
wonderful.
My name is Carl.
Hi, Carl.
And my background has been in tradition, the Christian tradition, as a child and teenager, and has broadened to include almost everything I can shake a stick at. So my current practice is primarily paying attention.
Okay, thank you. Wonderful. If you would?
I'm Eric.
Hello, Eric.
And I'd say definitely Christian in background.
All right.
And still exploring.
Excellent, thank you.
Rob, was a good Catholic altar boy, etc., way back when, and for the last 38 years, a Taiyu practitioner, Taiyu being the organization that owns and operates this store.
Wonderful. Thank you. Sir?
My name is David. I grew up Protestant, but lately my interests have gone towards Hindu, Buddhism, Middle Eastern, that general area.
Lovely. Thank you. And sir?
I'm Michael, and I'm with Interplanetary Playgrounds Incorporated. We do planets.
Planets. Cool. Wonderful. So, thank you very much. That's a help. Care to pitch in?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to pitch in?
Agnostic, science, philosophy, the whole work is all interesting stuff.
Excellent. Thank you, Ed. All right, so, great. That's the wheels are turning, adjusting how to talk. As alluded to, I'm a seminarian. I was trained by the Unitarian Universalists, so part of that whole training is to learn how to speak whatever language people speak in. So I'm rather a polyglot when it comes to speaking religion, and my task always is to serve the need of those before me. But I do have a substantial background in a couple of different places, as alluded to in my bio. A number of years ago, when I was in seminary, I had the opportunity to meet a lama who was fellow barely spoke English, but enough to kind of understand, and the professor was helping us to understand him. I was like, Buddhism, I don't know, it's kind of like pulling back from the world and all this kind of stuff. And so I started asking some questions, and that kind of changed my life. The practice that we just did, I understand it from the explanation that he gave at that time, because I said, well, why do we take refuge? It feels to me like we're like leaving the field of combat. There's so much work to be done here. Why would we be taking refuge? And he said, well, do you think you need help? Oh yeah, I could use all the help I can get. Refuge is asking for help and getting it and putting it to use. And from that moment on, it kind of changed, and I started chasing the bits and pieces that they were willing to share with me. And I had some very good teachers who, both on the academic and the practice side, who illuminated a lot of this material. And in particular, my professor in class would say, and the lamas were doing this practice, and then they discovered this problem with this practice. And so to fix this problem, they did this stuff. And I'm going, yeah, interesting practice. We have that problem in my spiritual community. that would be, we could apply that solution. Wait a minute. And after about a dozen of those, I started finding myself, wait a minute, what is this Tantra stuff that they're talking about anyway? What is this? And having then got introduced to it properly and get some training, I did a bunch of work to do what they say you're not supposed to do. But that would be me. You see, as a priest of Hermes, my job is to steal things. And what I steal is spiritual technology. And the Western tradition of esoteric spiritual technology, the Western magical tradition or Hermetic tradition or Kabbalistic tradition or what I would now call the theurgic tradition, has many holes in it because, well, the last couple of thousand years has not been kind to us. But we've been slowly putting it back together again. And since about 1428 forward, there has been a movement to try to rebuild the Western theurgic tradition. Now, have you ever heard this term theurgy before?
Theurgy, yeah.
Theurgy, okay, great.
Yeah, very old term.
Yes, it is.
2,000 to 3,000 years.
Yes, it is. It's a classical Greek term, at least from the late antique period, the Hellenistic period, when, let's see, we have the Roman Empire has now taken over the entire Mediterranean region, and so everybody's talking to each other. It's also an era of great peace, so there's an enormous amount of trade and travel. You could get across the Mediterranean fairly quickly, so the Greeks are going into Egypt, the Romans were, all these people were all talking to each other, and they discovered that there was something else going on that eventually was written about by a fellow by the name of Iamblichus, one of my heroes, a Syrian fellow, and he wrote a book which we refer to as De Mysteriis. The actual Greek title is long and verbose and kind of the answer of the master Abamon to the letter written to Anebo by Porphyry and answers to the questions raised therein, or something close to that. They weren't good on the pithy titles, so we call it De Mysteriis because of its major translator called it that. And it actually has nothing to do with the mysteries, oddly enough, but the fellow in the 1400s who was translating it didn't understand that. We do now. What he had to do with is a thing called theurgy. And in the Orthodox tradition, those who do the Catholic end of things with all that kind of ritual work, it is quite orthodox to understand it through Dionysius the Areopagite as a form of theurgy. A form of theurgy focusing on a singular deity. Traditional theurgy focuses on a huge range of deities, and that's kind of central to its practice, but working with one deity works too. But in tantric practice, tantra seems to have developed in parallel to the theurgy in the West. We can see in India at about the same time as we see in Syria and the Mediterranean around 2-300, the development of theurgy and what kind of practices it were. We see something very similar going on in India, but with the rise of Christianity, most of theurgy stops, and but India doesn't have that, so it continues to develop, and this becomes what we now call Tantra. And it's very similar in its methodologies, very similar in its purposes and approaches, but becomes more refined and much more efficient in its methodologies. In the ancient theurgic practices, well, first you go get the cow, and you say the appropriate prayers, you slaughter the cow, you offer that to the gods, you have a wonderful barbecue for you and your friends, and you contemplate all this. Eventually they began to figure out that you didn't actually need the cow. A little bit of incense did a pretty good job, and what seemed to have happened is that people prayed and practiced, they discovered that they would get into divine union. And that's how it kind of left it in the West. In the East, they developed a whole path of approach that goes from treating the deity as a vassal to a lord, to as a friend, as a lover, eventually as self, and even beyond that, which we'll talk a little bit about as we get into it. So this is the path of theurgy, is one of divine union. This in India is often called deity yoga, or deva samadhi, deity union. In the West, we call it theosis, or divine union. And so these methods show up in both places. But today what we're going to poke at is how we can use some of that in our practice in the West. Now, in the Christian tradition, the union with the deity is generally not acknowledged. In traditional Roman Catholic teaching, it is thought to be not possible. to unite with Yahweh, but other religious traditions do believe in that union. However, the practices of St. Thomas Aquinas in the spiritual exercises within that are actually a very similar methodology to the Eastern modes of union. And they basically involve imagining oneself going through the passion of Christ and as the Divine One, and going through that all that experience up to being crucified and eventually raised from the dead, as a way of identifying with Christ and integrating that in one's life. And this is common to Jesuit practice, the Society of Jesus. They will spend years doing this. A question, sir?
Well, in the Orthodox tradition, Christian, there is union, but it's through the light.
Indeed. I'm more familiar with the Roman. I didn't want to speak at a turn because I'm not quite sure the exact distinctions in this.
Yeah.
But there is some degree of union through the
divine.
Yeah. So, at which Iamblichus will be talking about Elampsis, which is the light that comes first. So, it's really quite similar. So let's see. So let's unpack this a little bit. Tantra. The word itself, tan, the root of it means to weave. It's the verb. And tantra is a building on that kind of notion. And the idea is several fold, one of which is mind weavings. We create these visualizations and practices that have transformative effects. So that's essential to the practice. But more core to the overall purpose of Tantra, Tantra emerges out of when you push impassivity and apatheia, not being unruffled by emotional experience, so far that it breaks. Because not everyone can do that. Not everyone finds that stilling their emotions is the best approach. Some people are extremely passionate, and trying to shut down the emotions actually causes more trouble. So some of them said, why can't we harness this? And that's part of the basis for Tantra. It helps if you're a passionate person to be able to practice Tantra. They say without that you don't have enough wood to build the fire. So part of it is for people who are emotional, and being one, I find it very useful. However, the task in Tantra is to unite the emotions with the path, and to be able to use them as part of your transformative process, to use the emotions as a mode of liberation rather than as a way of beating ourselves up or binding ourselves into worse and worse conditions, generating more karma and the like. So the task is to use the path of the emotions to liberate and free. Well, the method is what the visualizations are all about. So in Tantra, instead of denying sensation, instead of denying emotion, instead of denying any thought, we welcome all of these things and learn to cultivate them, to see them in a non-dual manner, to be able to relate to them not as good, not as bad, but just as what is, and thereby be able to use them effectively. So that's the core of what Tantra is about. Now here in the West, many people think of Tantra as sexual practice. Not entirely true, but not entirely false either. First off, we're talking about a culture very different from ours, in which sexuality has a naturally healthy kind of aspect to it. Our culture, we either use it for selling things or we say it's bad, and that dualism gets us into a lot of trouble. In cultures that don't do that, they tend to use sexual symbolism as part of their spirituality. And that's a big piece of what we see in Tantra. Most of it is symbolism. Most of it is a way of expressing fundamental concepts in an embodied and a visual form. And that's useful. It also has modes of sexual yoga in it, working with the channels and paths within the body with a partner. But those practices are, well, very advanced, and you have a lot of work to do before you even get there. And they're generally done either in couples or in highly ritualized frameworks. And that lies a little bit beyond our scope for today, but we'll allude to them, put them off on the side. So that's sort of the introduction to theurgy. Any questions to start? Very good. Tantra. Theurgy. That's the next one. Theurgy is theos and ergos. Theos, divine, deity. Ergos is work, so it's God work. The scholars are going, but that leaves too many possibilities in there, and they're forgetting their Greek. The Greeks were wicked punsters. If you could figure out different meanings in any given phrase in Greek, they probably meant it, particularly when they're getting technical. So it means working the gods, or the gods working us, or working with the gods, or working on behalf of the gods, or all of the other possible combinations you can imagine in there. And when you actually look at theurgic practice, they all show up one way or another. Ultimately, it's about working with the gods, aspiring to theosis, divine union, and ultimately henosis, union with the one or the all, so as to become, in the depth of practice, a co-creator in the cosmos, a fellow worker, a co-administrator of the cosmos, working to help bring about how the world must come to be. I presume you've all heard of Plato in the past, yeah? He wrote a marvelous one of his dialogues called the Timaeus. And in that, the demiurge is going about making the cosmos, and he's made the younger gods and big chunks of the cosmos, and then stops and says, all right, I'm going to stop here, because you guys need to continue making everything, because if I make everything, there are going to be things that are going to be left unmade, and then the cosmos will be incomplete and therefore imperfect. And so you all need to continue your creative process, and all the way down the chain, the beings you make need to continue doing this, and we are essentially, in this system, their product, and therefore we all have tasks to do, things to make here. And this is a way of relating our own inherent creativity and will to the fundamental impulse that brought about our cosmos in the first place. And so we all have work to do, and that's part of our challenge, part of our job here. And that's what theurgy is to help us to do, by reconnecting us to our divine source, so that we can do those creative projects that we're supposed to be doing down here.
Let me just ask, so you said that there are some parallels but different developments in theurgy in the West and Tantra in the East, and so along this line, it just occurred to me, is there a similar in the tantric perspective or worldview? Is there also a sense of what you just alluded to, in terms of a responsibility of human beings to creatively participate in the ongoing expansion, if you will, of the universe?
Indeed. They have a single word for it, dharma. You are to live your dharma. Unless you live your dharma, you don't really live your life. They wrote an entire epic about it, the Mahabharata. And of course, the Buddha Dharma and so forth all echo the same principle, the path that we need to do. And so the idea is we need to discover our dharma and get on it. Now, mind you, in Indian culture, that partly meant doing the work of your caste or such like things. But for us, it's a bit richer. We don't have something to tell us what to do, so we have to kind of figure that out. And in the West, that shows up in a tradition called Thelema in its strongest form, which the word itself is a koine, a late Greek word for will. And its fundamental conundrum is saying that your individual will is inherently connected to the will of the all, the divine will, and should you work and do that, your life will go along the most satisfactory, the most useful path for you. And this shows up in a variety of traditions, but as a Thelemite, somebody who does work that, that's what we call it. Question over here?
Associated with that, so theurgy, my understanding of theurgy, at least in Orthodox, is through purification.
Mm-hmm.
So, meaning there's a spectrum, long spectrum, between virtue and vice, and someone who's enlightened would be, and that spectrum from vice to virtue would be all on the virtue side.
Mm-hmm.
And purification, and that would be the enlightenment. And the theurgic experience that you're talking about.
I would actually argue that's only the beginning. The purification aspect of it produces a thing called epitidiotes, otherwise known as fitness. It comes from a Greek concept of wood being dry enough to burn. It's fit to burn. After you've seasoned, a log, so you can throw it in your fire, but if you throw in fresh wood, it doesn't burn very well. So the idea is that we get ourselves purified enough so as to permit divine presence to come through to us.
Exactly.
Right. And so, but in classical Greek theurgic practice, one, after sufficient purification, but also throughout the process, one then goes through a process of invocation and calling in the divine presence, cooperating with it as well. And what Iamblichus ends up discovering by working his way through thinking is like, okay, the term for this is kletor, to call, to summon. But the truth is we do not summon. We cannot compel the divine. However, what we're really doing is like a radio, tuning ourselves through the process of invocation to the divine, and as we hit the right channel, the divine comes pouring through.
That's basically what I would say.
Right. This is present in Dionysius the Areopagite, right, who was a student of a fellow by the name of Proclus, who was one of the very last of the Diadochos, or heads of the Platonic school, during the era when that was richly theurgic in its practices. And so that's how it passes into Christian framework.
Plotinus and all that?
Yes. Well, Plotinus wasn't exactly... Well, he was a Platonist, but he wasn't of the Platonic school. He didn't live at the academy. But Proclus, in fact, was the head of the academy for a time. So we have that there. And in theurgy, there's a series of steps along the way. We won't go into that in too much detail, because we're mostly talking the tantric side and one specific aspect of that. But purification is the beginning of it. The next stage is what I would call tonification, strengthening. So first you're getting rid of all the bad, and then in tonification you're strengthening all the good. Meanwhile, progressively able to invoke the deities in a more and more refined form. At first we invoke terrestrial deities, the local ones, and then we work up to the celestial realm, and then beyond that eventually into the divine realm itself, and eventually we can unite with the One, the Supreme, that is the whole of all being. And that's a talk for another night. But tonight we're going to talk about the specific aspects of deity work, and that's where the Tantra comes in. So, in Christianity there is a singular deity. In most other traditions, there's a plurality of deity, and each of them having very distinct characteristics. And in that, each deity form provides a certain way of being in the world, a way of moving through the world. You're probably at least somewhat familiar with the Olympian deities, like Jupiter and Apollo and Aphrodite and Hera. Yeah? You know some of those names? Each of those, we know from the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the rest of the Greek corpus, each have very distinct characteristics. Mars, for instance, he's a warrior, and that's the Roman form. The Greek form, Ares, is known as the young tough and the kid going around starting fights. In the Roman form, he's the dutiful soldier. Very different. He originally was a farming deity, actually, but eventually became associated with this martial form. Aphrodite, of love, grace, beauty, and the arts. Hera, running the household, and the good wife. Zeus, proper rulership and justice. Apollo, illumination, creativity, the performative arts. Each of these are different aspects of human experience. And to become good at any of them, one would invoke that deity in the ancient world. Iamblichus, one of my favorite writers of the ancient world, was said not to have sufficiently invoked the graces because he was actually kind of a pedantic and sort of miserable writer. I like the way he writes, but not everybody does. He drags along. So that gives you a bit of a clue. If you need something, you invoke the deities. And this is the essence of where we're going. Because with each deity that you invoke, you become more like that deity. And the process within both theurgy and tantra is to invoke deities so as to acquire more of their character, which is both the distinctive nature, whether it be a warrior or lover or artist, and the divine nature. So there's kind of a horizontal component of particular qualities and skills, and also the vertical component of becoming closer and closer to the One, closer and closer to the source of being, I would actually say that they were beginning to understand the void that lies beyond the one, but they didn't have the they didn't have the math, they didn't have the zero to help them figure out how to handle that. So they didn't quite develop shunyata, the void, as a concept. But the task of invocation is to call into presence the deity and blend ourselves with that deity so as to acquire more of its divine nature and its particular characteristics. I, for instance, am a priest of Hermes. I invoke Hermes quite a bit. And you might see that I'm somewhat loquacious and playful. Both of those are his characters. I'm also, I have to be careful because I can get sticky fingered. As a teenager I did do a bunch of thieving and eventually realized that was bad and wrong, so I stopped. I also learned how to spin stories, which was useful in my life in those days, but I've learned also from Hermes the value of speaking truth, the value of absolutely doing perfectly legitimate trade, to never lie, cheat, or steal, even though he's master of these things, because he is master of these things. And so these are qualities that were strong in me, and I had to master them, and through working with Hermes, I learned how to do so.
I'm making an objective comment right there. I trust someone more when that person is honest out of choice rather than by default.
I would think so too. So this is part of the purpose in working with deities, and what we find in, say, the Buddhist and Hindu traditions, similar kinds of things, except within the Buddhist tradition we also have the extra layer that these being wisdom beings, they embody certain aspects of enlightened nature. As to whether or not the gods do, that depends on which framework you want to operate from. The Buddhists are a bit mixed on that. The Hindus are a bit more in favor of it. The Westerners are trying to sort that out still. I would say yes, but the deities that I work with, I think, are actually Buddhas as well, so that probably confuses matters, but that's my opinion. But the core of it, though, is through invoking the deities, we acquire their characteristics, and in the modes of practice we're about to discuss, we do so very literally. And there is part of the interesting bit to this. So two major benefits of invoking deities. One, we become more divine, which in the Greek would be called apotheosis, becoming like unto the gods. And in the short haul, we acquire their characteristics and can wield their powers. And that's where where divine union becomes quite useful, because when we put on the forms of the gods, which is what we're talking about here, we then have access to their capacities. And whether that be to make art or to understand new technologies, a real benefit for Hermes. I make my living at stuff I was never taught how to do, because Hermes has taught me how to program computers, set type, do graphic arts, and all this kind of stuff, which is what I make my living at. I was never trained how to do this, but through understanding information through the gods' insight, I know how to sell that capacity and put bread on my table. So it's very real and very pragmatic to me in this case. Nonetheless, as a priest, my job is to make the benefits of that god available and to bless with that. And through any deity, one can find the path to the one, to that source of being. But in the theurgic practice, you'd actually invoke an array of deities so as to keep yourself balanced. Because, well, if you work only two with Hermes, you might find yourself lying, cheating, and stealing all too easily. And that's a bit of a challenge. So, let's start talking about how. And that's where this starts getting more fun. So, as I alluded to, there is a path of approach to deities where first we treat them as the great lord, the great lady, the great benign, beneficent one, and there's lots of bowing and scraping and those kinds of things, kneeling and knowing how different we are, and that's what we focus on at that layer of practice. But after you do that for a while, the relationship becomes more intimate and it becomes more friend-like. And we find the deity more present to us, and they show up to us. And as that cultivates, the practice becomes one of lover. And we have a variety of saints within the Western tradition. Hildegard of Bingham, Francis of Assisi, a number of others, all experienced the love of the divine and became enraptured within that. St. Anthony, I believe, is one of those.
Clare of Assisi, probably, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. All of these beings experienced and dwelt in the love of the love of God. And in the Indian tradition, the Buddhist tradition, literally one frames in with the deity and enters into a visualized sexual union with the deity. That's how intimate this lover relationship goes. But there is yet a further form of that. They have names for these. Kriya Yoga Tantra, Charya Yoga Tantra, Yoga Tantra, and then they have a thing called Maha Yoga Tantra, which is mostly what I want to talk about today. This is where you become the deity, and this is what I allude to in my little book over there. This is where you transform into the form of the deity. But this works either when you're worshipping the deity in front of you, or as you, and this is what I call a spirit in a bottle. What you first do is make a bottle. Here is our meditating person. Or, this is a statue of a deity, like any of these statues here, with the deity present in front. But that's the bottle. It can be visualized in front, and this is where you visualize the deity in all of their proper array. Take a look at any of these. You will see that they have certain distinctive poses and items that they're carrying. They have certain garb. They sometimes have people with them or other beings with them. So they have their retinue with them. They have their vehicle, like Ganesha on his mouse, or Shiva on his bull, and so forth. Each being having their own vehicle. They have their company with them. They have their various attributes, like Shiva with his trident and his serpents wrapped around him and the moon in his hair. Each of these kind of characteristics. And when you're invoking the deity, you visualize them. And if you read a sadhana or a traditional practice, there's a portion of it where sometimes it's recited, sometimes it's just imagined, where you go through all of the characteristics of the deity. And so you make them holding their various different objects, and they're wearing whatever appropriate funny hats that they wear, and they're wearing whatever clothing that they are. Mostly in Buddhist and Indian practice, they look like an Indian prince or princess. That's mostly what we see in this kind of garb. In the Egyptian, it's, well, more or less noble-type garb as well, wearing kilt and girdle and nemis and often the wast, the scepter that they carry there, but also other things. These are the traditional visualizations for them, which the Greeks would call the hieratic or priestly form of the deity, which is what the priest would teach you. This is what the deity looks like, sort of. Because, of course, these are ultimate beings. They don't have form like we do. But in this anthropomorphic form, a form that we can relate to, a form that we can identify with, they take on an anthropomorphic type of form, maybe with a few extra arms or some such, but nonetheless, it's more or less a human form. Now, the Greeks pointed out that probably when a cow sees a deity, it probably looks cow-like. When a dog sees a deity, it probably looks dog-like, because that's that entity relating to the divine one, and the divine one's going to probably show up in a form appropriate to those circumstances. So this is where they teach us, and the Buddhists are quite specific about this. Don't attach to this as though it was true. This is method. This is a means. So this is the first stage. Visualization. Okay, now you deal with my messy handwriting. Now you know I'm a typesetter. Can't think. So, the first stage is visualizing the bottle, the container. And you can put it in front of you as a sheer visualization. You can have a statue. You can have a painting, a tanka, this kind of thing. And in traditional practice, the object, if one was being used, might go through its own process of purification and consecration and such, so that it might be an appropriate vessel for the deity. Likewise, the individual, if we're going to visualize ourselves as the deity, we go through a process of purification so that we can reimagine ourselves as the deity. And this is referred to as symbolic recreation. We recreate ourselves in symbolic form. So that's the first stage. But that's just the bottle, that's just the shell. After that, you need some help. You need the actual spirit, the actual deity, to come in and dwell. So therefore we go through a process of invocation to invite the deity to come and indwell the bottle. So the deity actually is living over here in some heaven. So let's make that a cloud. Here's a cloud. And here's our little deity actually hanging out over here. And here's us calling. And so the deity comes and comes into the bubble. Comes in and indwells the visualization, the statue, the tanka, or ourselves. And often the deity would be imagined, visualized, and invited to come and dwell in our hearts. And indwell us there. And from there, enliven the visualization, enliven the statue, enliven the bottle, the shape that we have given it. And we know, the practitioner knows, that the deity is not the shape, but the shape is an expression of the deity. And thereby the deity can express itself in the world. So that's the second phase, is welcoming the deity. So, first we visualize, then we welcome the deity to come and dwell within. Okay, very useful. Oh, next one. Well, it's kind of there. It's what is it going to do? Well, we need to give it modes of articulation, and this is one of the places where the tantric methodology is really powerful. Possessing, as they do, a solid knowledge of the chakra systems, what next the practitioner would do is adorn the deity with the chakras. So in the Buddhist system, usually you get one on the brow, one on the throat, one on the heart, and then depending on which other system, you may get all the way down, you may get some side chakras, maybe a couple above, but Om Ah Hong, the core the three, that which are body, speech, and mind. And this is one of the traditions that does mind at the heart, like the Egyptians, oddly enough. This is body. Speech you kind of get. But speech is also energy. Speech is all the communicative capacities. So, with that, the deity is thought to be able to express themselves at the level of body, at speech, and of mind. And so we call these the hookups, the divine hookups, the ability to plug in and connect with us, the way of articulating themselves. So that's the third phase. So let's do one, two, three hookups. Great, someday I'll learn to spell. That's the next phase. But now that the deity is there, this is where it starts looking like ordinary worship, because the next two phases I think of as praise and bribes. First, you say, oh, it's so great to have you here, thank you very much. And in traditional worship, like if this was Tara, for instance, the deity Tara, you would then run through the 21 praises to the goddess Tara, and that those are her welcoming songs. And so it's, imagine you're welcoming a guest, and this is all based on the principle of welcoming the honored guest. So think of it when a guest comes to your house. Oh, it's so lovely to have you here. Let me take your coat, your hat, please sit down. Oh, it's so wonderful that you're here. Here, can I offer you something to drink, some food? Oh, how nice. This is what we do. This is hospitality. This is what this is all based on, except for as far back as we can see, both in the written and the unwritten record, humans have been feeding the invisible ones, the people who aren't there. Like putting out food, it's like, thank you very much. Well, this is what we do. This is a more sophisticated form of it, but the same principles apply. After we have the deity, we have their bottle, we have them there, we got hookups, then we say, thank you very much, and we might sing songs of praise to them, traditional hymns that we have been taught and such. And then we also put out offerings for them. If we're doing something very physical, we might actually be putting out food and drink and all that kind of stuff. We might be laying out an entire feast for them, and usually ourselves as well. Practice in Tibetan called sok is making food offerings, but this is no different from the ancient Mediterranean peoples, slaughtering the goat or the chicken and feeding the god, and then we eat. The Indian term for that is prasad. After the deity is eaten, then we eat of that food and we receive the blessing and grace of the deity. Okay? But in this case, sometimes we can do this in entirely symbolic ways. For instance, in the Tibetan tradition, there are a series of mantras and gestures that are used. So form, sound, smell, taste, touch, mind, father's milk, the paternal part, mother's blood, and a cake. And these are traditional offerings that are done so that you don't actually need any supplies. You can just visualize them, and many, many other things. Like, these are incense sticks, and they've got butter lamps, and all this kind of thing. Because, you know, there you are in your cave, you're meditating, there's nobody around, and you've got very limited supplies. You're eating, you know, a handful of grain a day. So what are you going to do? How are you going to make a luxurious place for the deity to show up? You know, they're treated like princes, so you visualize it all and use gestures and so forth to do this. The ancient theurgists were just beginning to figure this out. You can see it alluded to in De Mysteriis, but it didn't get to go any further. They're beginning to figure out that word and gesture and symbol are powerful ways of making offerings that are very effective to the deities. So, by this kind of methodology, we visualize the body, we welcome the spirit into the body, we give it the ability to work in our realm, we then say nice things and make offerings to it to engage it in our realm, because that's the problem with deities. They just flutter away, going back to their heaven, unless we give them something to hook into, something to connect with. So we do that. And if you're doing this as yourself, you're imagining these offerings in front of you, you're hearing the praises said as you have transformed into the deity. Once you're there, though, then the blessings of the deity can pour forth. If you're doing it in front, in this manner, like it's a statue or something like that, then you would speak to the deity and say, grant us long life, grant us beneficence, grant us illumination, whatever the prayers are appropriate to this particular deity, and go through some cycles around that. Or, if you have become the deity, you wield those powers yourself, and you send that blessing out to wherever it needs. So, if you're in a healing deity's form, and you know of people who are sick, you call them before you, either physically or imaginally, and you bless them, and you take away their diseases or injuries or so forth, and any other thing that the deity might be relevant to. That's kind of the core of it. There's more, but we have a little bit more time. Any questions thus far? Thoughts?
A lot of rational mind and thought in that. Whereas it's kind of similar to, you know, Hesychism, which would be involved with the Holy Spirit instead of that. But the path through that is more of an absence of thought to connect with the deity. So you're taking on all the attributes of that mentally and visualizing it, a lot of rational thinking.
No thinking. If you're thinking, you're doing it wrong.
Oh, okay. That's what it sounds like, because
you're just seeing it.
You're just seeing it.
Yeah, seeing it, feeling it, embodying it.
So you shut down the rational thought then?
Yes. Well, the pieces that I haven't gotten into is the preparatory and after practice that prepares you to be able to do this.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Okay. So do I understand correctly that you establish a structure initially with your thinking? You establish the structure. Then you let go of thinking about it and just do the structure.
That's a fair presentation of it, yes. It's more like art than reason, by far. You imagine. You use the power of the imagination to do this.
But you're following a pattern.
Right. And this is why ritual is useful, because it gives you the structure with which to create this. And also, regular doing it develops skills. And that's very, very helpful for being able to pull this off.
What happens to the places in negative?
Ah, okay, great. And this is where this is most useful, because after you've done all of these things, this is considered the outer work at this stage. Then the next stage is to work the channels and to actually build up the divine heat within the body. And so that's the subtle dimension to it. And this, in the process of doing so, cooks. It burns the kleshas out. It raises up the divine fire and actually burns out all of the obstructions, whether they be body, speech, or mind. So they start with the body, and it's more purification at first.
and then it starts clearing out the channels through that kind of fire and heat, and then it gets to the subtle fire that burns out all of the subtle obstructions at the level of mind. And therein, through the cultivation of ecstasy in this, you see, this process actually at first is laborious and slow and all this thinking and all this kind of stuff, but after you get skilled at it from doing it enough, you can visualize the deity in an instant, take on the channels and run them instantly, and then move right into the mind of the deity, because you're trying to achieve union first at the level of symbolic, then at the level of the fires and energies of the divine one, and eventually achieve the mind of the deity.
So it does produce a blissful ecstasy.
Indeed, when you're doing it correctly, which takes a little bit of practice, you eventually get to a point where the entire experience is profoundly ecstatic.
See, I'm very familiar with ecstasy and bliss, but that's associated with divine light.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're saying. That's
right. The deity usually comes in a beam of light, a cloud of light, and this becomes progressively more radiant and shining as you develop the practice and as you purify ever more.
So then, is there actually a visualization of light? What I'm saying is
no, you don't need to visualize it. It lights.
And what I'm saying is a visualization where you actually, an actual scene.
Yes.
Of light in darkness.
Yes.
There is.
Yes. Profound. All of these become colored centers that just radiate out light, even to the point that somebody in the room will see you. You're holding this seeing light coming off of you. And with that, then siddhas, powers, begin to emerge, and that light becomes useful. Purifying, strengthening, healing, those kinds of things. And through the cultivation of pleasure and ecstasy, actually it's a threefold thing, openness, radiance, and pleasure are the subjective forms of wisdom, power, and compassion. And as these things rise up, we can then focus on pleasure and let that open out. It's kind of an unfolding kind of thing. And then openness of mind emerges with that, and flowing of radiance and energy moves with that, and they each reinforce themselves in a profoundly ecstatic experience. And in that, non-dual awareness emerges. That's sort of the mind side of it. And the kleshas, the obstructions, the karmas, right down to karma, will start burning out. And this is the truly magical portion of this, is because instead of simply having to work out one's karmas, one can, through practices like this, burn through one's karmas, and they clear out a lot quicker that way. And this is why in this mode of practice, which is called Vajrayana in the Tibetan Buddhist and the Buddhist practices, this is thought to be able to produce complete Buddha enlightenment in a single lifetime, because you're able to burn through the karmas of innumerable lifetimes in a single one through this taking on of divine presence.
Cool.
It is. It's pretty amazing.
From a Christian point of view, that would be taking on the enlightenment would be a complete abstinence from evil. So the purification meaning there is no evil.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the only way, and from a Christian perspective, it would be related to that.
Indeed. Well, identifying with the divine and then becoming a proper servant and manifestation.
What I mean is, if the person is totally identified and totally centered in that presence, mm-hmm. with that ecstatic sensation that you're talking about, that enlightenment, then there is no room that burns away any presence of any evil, so that evil has no access to the mind.
Yep. And as Iamblichus would say, that through the practice of theurgy, good comes and evil flees.
Right.
Pushes it away.
The light pushes away the evil.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What ends up happening to the theurgist is there's less and less reason to actually do any particular, like, try to do any magic, try to do any particular benefit, because it just flows from the divine presence. And instead of, I got to do a spell, or I got to do some ritual to, you know, get something to happen for myself. Instead, it's always going back to the deity, and to the invocation of the deity, to union with the deity, and astonishing
way more creative solutions to problems emerge. To the point of like, why would I ask for anything in particular? They know so much better than anything I could ever possibly pray for. Just take care of me, and I will serve.
Please. So you referred to like the banishment or departure of evil,
mm-hmm.
but you also said earlier about the non-dual frame of mind mm-hmm. that you encounter. In a non-dual frame of mind, wouldn't you see what it formerly appeared as evil in a different light?
Indeed.
So it's not that the situation or condition or whatever went away. It's been transformed into
something. Transformed. Indeed. And this is where the Buddhists had this marvelous thing called the poisons and the wisdoms. And they are what they eventually teach you. At first they say, oh, avoid the poisons, these horrible things, and strive towards the wisdoms, and eventually when you get far enough along, you say, no, actually they're the same thing. The things like anger and wrath are actually clarity with clutching. And when we can unclutch, as the Buddha said, you know, as the second noble truth, as we relax, the anger and its ferocity opens out with compassion. And all that energy is still there, but it's no longer wrath. It is incredible perspicacity. And all of the bad thing that one was reacting to is still really there. You still see it. But you have the energy to actually engage it, but it's now without the desire to destroy it. It's just, oh, well, maybe that needs destroyed. Maybe it needs help, healing. And that's part of the non-dual thing. It's like, maybe we squash it. Maybe we heal it.
What's to be healed?
Yes. So that lies the problem of trying to talk about the non-dual.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So we're just about at the end of our time, and I've gotten through a fair bit of what I wanted to talk about. So,
can you alluded to the pre and post?
Yes. Okay. I give that briefly. Okay. So this is the core of the practice, but there are a set of things one does before going into the practice, and from painful learning, there's also a set of things that are useful to do after the practice. Because as you might imagine, by turning yourself into a deity, first it may take some work to get there, and then afterwards, before you can drive the car, it is useful to be able to get your feet on the ground, or ride the horse, or whatever it happens to be in your life, but most of us drive cars. So the build-up and the breakdown dimensions to this are rather important. So in the build-up side, as we did earlier, you take refuge. You go for help. Then you get the right attitude on. And this is one of the things that the Buddhists are brilliant about. It's a thing called bodhicitta, or wisdom attitude, the enlightened mind. And this is the idea that we do not practice merely for ourselves, but for the benefit of all beings. We strive towards enlightenment. We want to become Buddhas. We want to unite with the divine so as to benefit all being and bring all to that state. So that's the second phase. And how you do that is somewhat rare. The next thing is the cultivation of merit, the good merit that we have. In the practice, the Buddhists uses a thing called the Four Immeasurables, where we cultivate loving kindness, compassion, joy in the joy of others, and equanimity. And perhaps someday I can come back and take you through some of the basics of this. But that's a ring, actually, and each one is the antidote for the previous one. And they all cycle together. But in the process of doing that, what it does is it gathers up your good karma and all of your good strength, all the good that you've done, activates it, and it kind of puts a wind in your sails, a strength to be able to then go and do what you're about to go do. And then there's one more thing. You have to destroy the universe. You dissolve the universe into the void. Now, there's a particularly Buddhist aspect to it. What you're doing is you're clearing the slate, making everything blank, and then rebuilding everything. So you dissolve the cosmos into the void, and this is called the cultivation of wisdom, because the understanding of the void nature of being in Buddhism is central to their understanding of wisdom. So in terms of the actual work, after you've built up your good karma, you then clear the decks. You just dissolve everything away until you're resting in sheer emptiness. And into that emptiness, you throw usually a seed syllable, an essence, a something special about the deity, and then the deity emerges out of that, either as yourself or in front of you, as we've been discussing.
So then you are the deity, the deity's there, you render worship, you receive benefit, all that kind of blessing, and then it's time to say goodnight. If the deity is in front, usually then the deity is said to please depart unto your realms, and the deity kind of pops out of the bottle and goes back where they come from and dissolve it. Or the deity may at some level indwell the statue if it's appropriately cared for and such, but and be an ongoing blessing. But by saying, okay, you can go home now, you're telling the deity we're going to be shutting down. You're telling yourself we're going to be shutting down now. So then you go through a process of doing that shutdown. Some of the Tibetan stuff on this can be very funny because some of the pieces of it read rather legalistically. There's a prayer that goes something like, if we did too much of anything, please ignore it. If we didn't have enough, please fill it in. If we ran on to, it's just all of the things you could possibly do wrong in a ritual. You run through a list and say, please, it's called a prayer for forbearance. We're stupid humans and we don't always have things correct. Please, please give us the benefit anyway, even if we didn't quite get everything right. But more importantly, for the actual practitioner, is stepping down from the divine state. So one of the first things that is done is the recognition that all form, energy, and thought show forth primal, bornless presence. May this play of manifestation develop my body, speech, and mind, and that I may lead all living beings to also attain. Now, a prayer like that of remembering, oh yes, I've been just doing a crazy visualization. I've been having fun being God. Great, okay, time to put that down now. And then we go through a process of blessings. And in the Tibetan tradition, you would remember your lineage, you would remember your community of practice, and pray for them and their all their benefits. And then go through any other beings that you might be benefited by that. And then you finally come to a thing called the dedication of merit. And this is vital. Because what they discovered is that if you're being this world-shaking being, and trying to come down and actually hang out with your fellows in the monastery, at the coffee shop, whatever it happens to be, after you've done this, the ego kind of can get kind of puffed up. But through dedicating the merit, the good of what's been done, this all can come down. And so it's a peculiar, kind of tricky sort of thing. What you do is take all the good you've done through this practice and give it away. But not just give it away to people in general, you give it away truly to all, which, oddly enough, you happen to be part of the class of all. So it's kind of like pouring it out the front door while sticking it in your back pocket at the same time. And the Buddhists think of it as putting it in the bank. Because by doing this, you make it part of the ocean of beneficial energy in the world, and it helps all beings towards enlightenment. So it goes something like this. May the benefit of this act and all acts be dedicated unto the complete liberation and the supreme enlightenment of all beings everywhere, pervading space and time, so mote it be. May the benefits of practice, ours and others, come to fruition, ultimately and immediately, and we remain in the state of presence. And then, by one means or another, they send it all out. In our tradition, what we do is we sound a syllable ah again, and just... and send it all out into the world to benefit all beings, including ourselves. And that's how we open and close our practices. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Are there any other questions? Anything else?
So, you've described the adaptation, if I understand you correctly, the adaptation of Tibetan, these Tibetan tantric practices to your own Western theurgic practices.
Indeed.
And so, I mean, I've heard other practitioners speak not with the sort of elaboration that you've just offered us tonight, but some at least of the basic principles. So would you say that this is a I guess my question is I'm trying to get a sense of your practices are obviously the result of your own research with the tantricas, the tantric practitioners. and you have adapted it for your Western practices, as I understand it, as a priest of Hermes, for example. So, so is this something that you would that is available to other? I assume you would say that this is available to other theurgic Western practitioners, and that's the point.
Indeed.
And is there anything else that you would leave us with on this point?
really deep waters. What I mostly discovered in doing this is the interoperability of the Western and Eastern practices. They made sense in the doing, not always in the explanations.
Mm-hmm.
And I've evolved explanations that come out of the doing, and people who are other practitioners on both sides say, yeah, that's not a bad presentation of that. I've developed my own phrasing for them. But they're more rooted in my experience than in anything that I was ever taught, though that was, of course, the basis for entry. And seeing how they work so smoothly, both sides, it tells me that we're all humans, that this the divide between East and West is nowhere near so much of a division as many would like us to believe. So my little book is a way of explaining each of these different phases in this process, intended to, and as I say up right in front of it, I'm working with this particular deity because I have some interesting opportunities, and I've worked on this. At the time I wrote this, I'd worked on this practice for 15 years before publishing anything about it, and had taught it to a few dozen people across that time. But it's intended so that people can see how it looks in one solid framework, and then they take the pieces that work for them and rebuild them as required. And we have a wonderful Hermes practice that's rooted in the same methodology, a Hecate practice, and a couple others that are being cooked yet.
So in other words, this is not just rooted in your particular, open source order of the Golden Dawn, or whatever particular. But it is intended, this handbook, if you will, is to be adopted by people who seriously want to actually do, as opposed to just talk about doing.
Indeed, it's a manual of practice.
Yeah.
Very specific details, gotchas, and all kinds of issues with it. Trying to explain it as best I can through text. I pretty much stand by those descriptions. They're fairly well crafted. As ways that people can enter into these practices and shape them for their own purposes.
Got it. And based on whatever their background
and
inclinations are.
When I publish things out into the world, I have to let go. It may be my children, but in the same way as we have to send our children out into the world, they go out and it's like, do good. And here, maybe other people can benefit from them.
God,
at whatever level is appropriate to them.
I have a short question. Is the Roman Mercury any different than the Greek Hermes? Is it just a different name? In other words, does Mercury have any attributes apart, separate from Hermes? Two different names.
Well, I work with the entire Thoth, Hermes, Mercury line of deities. That's my series. And so each of them are very distinct to me.
What's the difference in short?
Tahuti is the Egyptian form.
Jesus
is very austere. The problem I find with Mercury is he may give you many of the benefits of Hermes, but you better check your wallet by the time he's gone. And yeah, he's likely to teach you things about like biological warfare and nuclear arms and all those kinds of fun things.
There's more of an emphasis on the Prince of Thieves.
Yeah, and his morals are really different from Hermes.
Interesting.
Yeah, and a little bit tricky and dangerous. I have come to understand that in his own way he's good, but he is also...
Does he have a warrior aspect?
Well, you gotta understand, Hermes' method of warfare is to, like, lull you to sleep and cut your head off.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened to Argus. That's why he's called Argifontes, the slayer of Argus.
How about Thoth? Thoth, same as Tahuti?
Yes, Tidutai. Tahuti is Thoth.
Just another way of saying Tahuti.
Yeah, Thoth. It's more the Greek interpretation of the Egyptian word.
Okay. Another short question. Is there any difference between Thoth and Hermes?
Yeah, really big.
So does Thoth have more attributes? than Hermes? Is he more encompassing, more broad?
I find him higher up the chain and more wisdom focused, and not quite as friendly or as kind.
Aren't they the same guy, Thoth, Tahuti, and Hermes Mercury?
They are of the same series, the Greeks would say, but not the same god. The Egyptians are very big on not confusing deities.
Well, okay. We have a difference there. I just thought, you know, Hermes is the thrice greatest, and my understanding, my thinking, that Thoth and Hermes and Mercury are the same guy, maybe different incarnations, mm-hmm. I don't know.
It's,
who knows?
It is true, but it is also wise to understand, just as different incarnations produce different personalities.
Right.
It's the same essence, I would say, but different manifestations appropriate to Egypt, to Greece, and to Rome.
Okay, interesting.
And what I find with Mercury is you better check your wallet.
Unless you're poor like me, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, he's funny about that. So, yeah. Anything else? And thank you so very, very much for your attention. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. On behalf of Many Rivers, it's our pleasure to have these opportunities to hear things that people are not going to hear many other places. So thank you again. I want to point out that we have our deity Odin over behind the desk there is about to put out a donation bowl. Which, oh, I see it there. I didn't see it where in its usual spot. It is elevated tonight. Must be a sign. It is elevated from its usual location there. There is the donation bowl. We encourage you to contribute to it. We shared donations with our speakers to help further their work, and we also retain half to maintain this space for further such events in the future. And, of course, we've got these... very interesting books here for sale, and we hope you take a look at those and avail yourself of the possibility of getting a signed one even. So thank you so much for coming tonight.
Wonderful. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.